You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks. Just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. Today, I'm talking to Trevor Francis, founder and CEO of 46 Labs. We dig into how he bootstrapped an 80 million telecom infrastructure company by staying lean, ignoring the VC playbook, and solving the problems others walked past. You'll hear how staying lean for over a decade gave them more leverage than funding ever could, how they earned the trust of billion-dollar carriers, and how they scaled through acquisition without losing their culture. It's a sharp conversation about the power of constraint, and what happens when you commit to building something that people would miss if it was gone. Well, hi, Trevor. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. I was looking forward to this. For a number of reasons, there's a number of words that came out in the research that I did. One was bootstrapping, building a business that's profitable, building a company that has a long-term vision and actually makes decisions having the long-term in mind. So when I saw what you were doing, I was like, this is a good candidate for the podcast. So hence we are here. Before we start talking about the company 46 Labs, what drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
I'm solving problems, frankly. You know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs say the same thing. 46 Labs is born out of my experience working with legacy infrastructure providers and equipment in the telecom space. So I thought, gosh, it was originally born out of Big Iron, right? So, you know, phone companies have historically built phone networks using, physical infrastructure, not anything digital. So I took it as an opportunity to say, okay, well, not only is there, some asymmetry in the market as it relates to infrastructure, but there's not a great deal of people who actually know how to manage this stuff effectively. So there's that aspect of it. You combine those two together, turning hardware into software and being able to manage it. That's how you got 46 Labs.
And then it was born, exactly. Well, one of the things, like one quote that I read from you was about fixing what others ignore. It's a principle that guides my entrepreneurial journey.
You know, it's a lot easier to fix it before what you ignore actually becomes a pretty serious problem, right? And we're seeing that now in the United States where kind of the trend has historically been that the network was the product, right? So they wanted to have full, complete control over it. And they never, the concept of ever outsourcing the network to someone else, that was just a foreign concept, right? Now what we found is that everyone's rushing to outsource it because the market's changed and what they view as value creation has changed pretty drastically. And what they're focused on has changed. So now the underlying kind of core public switch telephone network is it's not in vogue to be able to manage that network anymore. So basically the market has caught up, with the vision that I had 12 years ago, 13 years ago when the company was started.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
but it took that long.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's switch to the company. Mm-hmm. What was that problem that you saw back in 2012 that was screaming for something different? Is that...
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Is that what you just talked about? What was specific? What sparked it?
Well, it was born really out of financial necessity. What I saw was there's a huge amount of market consolidation that was happening, and the smaller players in the market were getting crowded out by larger players who had much larger balance sheets, and you just saw just a huge amount of consolidation happen in the market. So, in order to kind of democratize and basically create a competitive environment for smaller providers to continue operating. That's when I realized that, like, look, you're going to have to actually drag real costs out of managing networks and out of procuring infrastructure and being able to offer that infrastructure as a service versus having to make a big giant CapEx investment and hire an entire staff to be able to manage it. That was the opportunity.
Yeah, can I imagine? Yeah, indeed. I see the consolidation happening in Europe, the big telcos, and it's a fewer and fewer and fewer. And yeah, since technology is also going faster and faster, going from 3G to 4G to 5G to whatever is going to happen from here onwards, the constraints are just getting bigger and the life cycle shorter. So you need a lot of capital to be competitive. So interesting that you jump into a market whereby you and make a step forward for the smaller ones. So having started the company back then, 2012, was like still pre-AI. Cloud was, of course, big in swing. What was, I'm always intrigued by how you then start. You get so many technology options. What was an early decision that you took back then that appears to be really helpful for where you are today?
Well, bootstrapping, frankly, because if we'd raised a round of capital with what we were trying to do, then A, we would have been out of business a long time ago. Because capital in general has a fairly short mindset as far as being able to exit or monetize. And you do that a couple ways, by selling the company or through other rounds, right? So other rounds of funding, they take out earlier investors in many cases, or those investors continue. Since we bootstrapped the company, and it was started with $100,000. It was not, we were, starting a software company today with all the tooling and everything that's available with AI, that's still just a really small amount of money, right? Like before AI, you had all these, developers having to actually write code. You couldn't have, GPT write code for you, right? So, starting with that kind of constrained mindset, allowed us to kind of force the boundaries for what technology was capable of, more out of necessity, right? So we didn't have a huge budget to go out and buy, Amazon Web Services. We actually had to roll our own servers and procure our own colocation and do all of those things, which made us really good at infrastructure. So now we manage, dozens of data centers around the world. And if we were in a non-capital constrained environment, we're like, oh, we'll go cloud on everything and then just do that, right? It would have been enormously expensive, and we wouldn't have built our chops on the infrastructure side of things like we have today.
Exactly. Smart choice. Yeah, of course you need to be able to fund it. What has been your secret there to keep that funding and an income, well, the capital that you need in order to expand, to keep that in the right balance?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge, right? So, for the first 3 years of the business, I didn't draw a salary. So it all went straight in, right? And you have to have someone who, at least on the leadership side of things, that has the wherewithal or the patience of their family to, forego taking salary and living, exclusively out of savings, right? Most people can't do that, especially like young
True.
entrepreneurs. So, it was a huge sacrifice for my family to be able to do that, in general. And then we just grew out of revenue from that point forward. We have some private credits, which basically is just expensive bank debt that we use to basically accelerate our growth once we hit that inflection point. And that's what allowed us to go from an $8 million company that was grown exclusively from bootstrapping to our $10 million company to an $80 million, almost $100 million company today. And that was a very, very small amount of debt that we raised on the business. So it allowed us a lot more freedom to grow organically versus having to just throw money, just incinerate money at trying to get market traction.
Exactly. So when was the inflection point? In what year?
Well, so we did some strategic deals with a large wireless carrier here in the United States and with a large unified communications equipment manufacturer, and that was kind of the inflection point where we're like, okay, we've got something here. It's mess, you know, it's there is an opportunity to scale this thing beyond just kind of normal like organic growth going up. And that was born, both of those were born out of a vision to not only support carriers, which has historically been our primary customer base, but also support large enterprises, because we found that large enterprises had the exact same issues that carriers had in managing their communications globally. So that's once we kind of triangulated on that, our first customer was one of the largest global airlines in the country on the enterprise side of things. So normally you kind of toe into like moving from, you know, one sort of customer cohort to another one, like you start with a smaller one. We just happen to start with a giant one, right? So we have and continue to solve that problem for them, and you know, the rest is history from there. That kind of validated our thesis that, hey, look, this problem is actually bigger than just a carrier issue. It's a business, a large business issue.
Interesting. So yeah, it's again looking at those problems that others ignore, fixing what others ignore. And then when you understand the problem in real detail, you start finding, yeah, that others in different industries might have the same thing that you can solve with the same type of problem. Yeah. So how have you, I mean, in terms of the growth, is it more a linear type thing, or has it like been slow in the beginning, which is what I expect, and then started to scale exponentially after that?
Yeah, I mean, we're a 12 to 13 year overnight success. So, I
Yeah,
mean, that's kind
if
of
I
what it's
ask.
looked like, right? So, from a revenue perspective, that the company grew steadily for 12 years, right? Just continued getting better, and the growth grew from there. You know, it accelerated as we got bigger, but this last year has been parabolic, mainly through our acquisitions.
Okay. Yeah, that's another one I want to kind of tap into a little bit later. Yeah, talking about getting that first traction, what has been the hardest nut to crack in that? Was that what you typically would expect? Trust, because you know you're a small vendor, now you're dealing with one of the largest carriers out there. What has been the hardest nut to crack on that journey to get the adoption going?
I mean, it's less about, you know, when a customer has a problem, they're looking for any port in the storm, frankly. You know, they're much less picky on who they use if really you're the only one who can provide the solution to it, right? So we really focused heavily on the problem and not necessarily on trying to figure out how we market ourselves. But frankly, the kind of the longest pole in the tent is just how slow big businesses move, right? They're very deliberate in their decision making. You know, there's a lot of stakeholders who have to participate in those decisions because no one wants to make a mistake. So, you know, us focusing on trying to solve problems that no one else can solve leaves us as the only solution for those problems, right? So they're willing to overlook the fact that we're smaller and that we didn't, at the time we entered into contracts, didn't have all the certifications. They gave us time to get certifications for security and all of that, and to basically partner with us in solving the problem versus us being just a simple vendor.
Let me make a small interruption here. Trevor just made an excellent remark that sets his solution apart from conventional startup thinking. Focusing on trying to solve problems that no one else can solve leaves them as the only solution for those problems. This single principle eliminated competition and allowed them to command premium pricing. It's what remarkable software companies do. They acknowledge that they cannot please everyone. Then they focus on the essence. And lastly, they master the art of curiosity. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. You can download it at theremarkableeffect.com. 10 minutes of reading, and you'll start to see opportunities everywhere. Back to the interview. Yeah, it comes all the way down to differentiation, right? You say it right. You're solving a problem that no one else wants or does, or you're solving it in a way that no one else can do it, because at the end, problems can be solved in many different ways, and that takes away a lot of the objections. See this all the time. Let me see. So you start to grow your first number of customers. You said, okay, we of course I founded the company. We moved it now from 10 to 20 to 50 to 80 to 100 million. What was that moment where it started to become predictable, and what made it predictable?
It's never been predictable, right? So, I wish it was. It's if, we're in a slow-moving industry that, that is highly unpredictable because we're all kind of just waiting for the next disruptive technology that comes in that space. So, I would love to say, part of one of the, I guess, the battle scars of being a bootstrapped organization is that you really pay attention to the way you spend money, right?
True.
Because it was, your decision making meant whether you're going to make payroll or not, right? So when you've scaled, trying to understand what it looks like when when you've got a payroll of 15 people versus 100 people, right? It's just being able to kind of balance that aspect of this while you've got a market to some degree. We're in the process of trying to drive transformational change in the market because we've gotten big enough now that we have enough mass and inertia to say, okay, this is where it needs to go. We're going to drive towards that, right? So to some degree, we're in control of the change that we're looking to create, but it also scares us because we're like, you want to drive towards a directional transformational change. You just want to make sure that what the direction that you're going is not off a cliff.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
Right.
true. That is, of course, always the path that you choose. You either choose to be different and choose your own path and make those bets, or you follow someone else. And of course, when you're already ahead of the market, it's harder to follow someone else. That is actually also sort of something that I read about what you're doing. There was a topic that I read about, like I would summarize it as calculated risk taking, making bets. And particularly in relation to the long term, where you want to be long term, what I see with a lot of companies, because everything is so unpredictable, and because there's so much pressure on everybody, you start getting stuck into the short term. What is your secret to stay out of that short term ism?
And I think that, again, going back to being a capital constrained, even though we're not as capital constrained today as we have been in times past, I always like to keep that mindset inside the company because it allows people to it hyper focuses them on trying to solve what the kind of core problem is and solve it in unique and different ways. Because what historically you've seen in general is that a company gets to a specific point, right? And then they start making short-term decisions because they're like, okay, I'm finally here, but I'm not willing to, I don't they change their mindset as they gain success, right? So, we've resisted that change primarily out of just it's we've been born with 12 to 13 years worth of constraint, right? So it's part of the culture that keeps us focused on the long term versus the short term.
Yeah, and because you're bootstrapped, there's no one else to report to or to ask for permission.
Well, beyond asking for permission, there's, if you're 13 years in on an investment, you haven't seen a single nickel come out of it, right? Like either through distributions or anything like that, you keep plowing in, eventually you're going to want your money back, right? With a
Yeah.
return. That's the
Yeah.
goal, right? So being bootstrapped and the equity owned by, a vast majority of it from the folks who work in the business every single day, when with
Yeah.
long-term vision, it's easier to not have to manage to that kind of short-term thinking.
Yeah. In the 12 years, I mean, I can imagine you've seen a variety of competitors, some sticking and some maybe even failing. Has that same mindset also been the secret to staying around and getting stronger? Or has it been another thing? What have you done differently to not fall over?
Well, I think, you always have to question whether it makes sense to be in a specific market, right? Like you're always
Yeah,
having to
true.
question that because you've got such, if you're being careful with how you spend your money, you have to ask whether there's any sort of longevity in doing that versus just putting kind of one foot in front of the other. And you're like, I'm always we're in this market where, darn it, we're gonna see it all the way down to the end. That's a really horrible way of looking at, at longevity. Either growing or dying, right? So you can't stay stagnant from that perspective. And frankly, these acquisitions that we've done were kind of born out of seeing opportunity in places where, both companies were private equity owned when we bought them, right? So they're,
All right.
private equity companies are very focused on maximizing value in the short term because they're generating a return, right?
Yeah,
So
true.
either direct return or derivative return from those companies being in their portfolio. So what that means is they're not generally investing in the businesses, right? They're in harvest mode. They're trying to harvest what's available, right? So that allowed us to get to see kind of the requisite value that we needed to say, okay, well, we can take this, we can apply our technology, we can mash it down into much more efficient businesses, and then we can leverage the stuff that still is there in those businesses to grow. So I think there was a article that I had with another media agency where I was talking about fixing broken toasters, so being able to
Yeah,
bang
exactly.
dents out of things, right? So, these were to some degree broken toasters when we acquired them. They had not kept up with the pace of the market, but they had great relationships with their customers and they were trusted companies. So we saw the opportunity in those cases with being able to expand our reach, right? With people who had great reputations in the space, but had not kept up with the pace of technology. So it was a kind of a natural fit for us to bring the technology. They brought the customers and the commercial relationships, and then we kind of mashed it all together.
Exactly. I think I heard something that resonates a lot with me because I mean I've also been in a business that have been acquisitive, and one of the things was to get access to markets with maybe legacy technology or other means in particular areas. It could be adjacent markets, could also be a completely different country. But what the word that always triggers me is leverage, and I think that's what you did in a very good way.
Well, I mean, there's two different forms of leverage here in this case, right? So for us, it was leveraging to get market. What was interesting that we've seen both with the customers and vendors that we acquired is they needed us for leverage to be able to modernize their networks as well. So they're like, wow, what a great, a great acquirer because you guys are bringing kind of the next generation stuff, and we've been wanting to be able to do it, but it's hard for us to do it because we're not willing to go out and step into working with a new vendor and all of that. So we're it was that helped expedite their transformation plans as well. Because especially in the telecommunications market, there's no, especially for IT administrators and people who are operating those networks, the only benefit to any sort of change is cost reduction or efficiency, right? Making it easier to manage. Everything else is bad, right? Because migrations, they almost universally cause downtime. It raises eyebrows about things, technical debt that had been sitting in the business for potentially decades. You reveal all of that stuff whenever you make transformational changes. So it's why IT administrators are so resistant to change because there's only a small amount of upside for them. It's almost universally downside. Carriers too.
Completely agree. Yeah, I've seen it on the other side as well, and in other in the industries where I've been in, it's everybody always thinking about, okay, it's such an opportunity, it's great technology, and you can do so many things with it, but we don't think about the cost and the risk that comes with it in order to make that move. So what have you then done on the acquiring company side to ensure that what was there that you could leverage that and then integrate it in a way that starts to work for you? Because you're not only integrating technology, it's also, of course, teams. There's so many things happening to that.
Yeah, I mean, so we have a very strong, and Philip can attest to this too. We have a very strong culture inside of 46 Labs, and it's not for everybody. So we're very fast moving. We're a doctor's not patients sort of mentality where if you see something, say something or fix it yourself, right? Pick the hammer up. It's not like you kind of shove it aside. There's true agency in the people who work with us. When you're acquiring private equity owned companies or kind of longer term companies, that same agency doesn't exist. You have a hierarchy of of approvals and all of those
Okay.
things. So one of the biggest challenges that we've had has not been on, I mean, I'm sure the technology integrations and all that are just those are kind of, you have a very kind of linear path to being able to solve those. But the interpersonal stuff, the team building side of things is really the biggest challenge, because you either have to find people who are wholesale adopting your methodology, or there's not a really great fit. So it's not a great fit for the company. It's not a great fit for the people either. So and there's really only two ways to solve that, right? You can either try and indoctrinate the culture that you have as the acquirer on the subsidiaries that you hired, or you give them an opportunity to exit gracefully. So we've had both happen with our with the company.
Exactly. Yeah, and both are different for different type of companies and in different stages where they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's challenging, and no one really likes to talk about this. You hear this word synergy that happens in M&A activity, and synergy just means firings, right? Basically, it means people losing their jobs. It's one of the most challenging things in M&A transactions, because especially for the acquirer, because universally you look like the bad guy, right? Like you look like the person who's come in and shaken things up, and we're not a nonprofit organization, right? Like we're a for-profit organization, and our job is to advocate on behalf of our customers and our stakeholders, not necessarily our employees, right? Or our acquired employees. So, however, our employees are literally, they sit at the top stack of our order of needs, because without people, we just can't function as a business. So that integration period gave us an opportunity to kind of find the people who really wholesale sold out for our culture, and the ones that didn't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a but brings back memories, but that's a completely different story. Now you grow organically, you grow through acquisition. You start with one market, then you go to maybe one adjacent market and another adjacent market. What it typically does is that it sort of it's yeah it, you get scattered focus. How do you yeah what are you doing to ensure that you keep the focus that is relevant rather than just skimming out into different places that don't benefit from each other anymore?
That's super hard to do, right?
It
So,
is.
I kind of say this like jokingly, half jokingly, but I'm a recovering engineer. So, my background has historically been in engineering. So I love technology, right? So if you love technology is going to take you in 1,000 different directions all at once, right? And you're trying to basically determine what is the right direction for the business based upon the new technologies. Now, AI has completely upended all of that recently, right? We're still just at the very early stages of seeing what that's going to look like, not just for our business, but for the industry in general. However, to some degree, that 3/4 of your focus has to be on taking care of the existing problems and needs that your customers have, with 25% focused on trying to skate to where the puck's going to be, right? That's kind of how it is. It can't be inverted. You can't try and skate to the puck and then have 25% of just trying to keep the lights on, right? So it's that's a really challenging balance of keeping that keeping those two needs properly represented inside the organization.
Yeah, exactly. That's where the long-term focus comes in place again, that you keep that the other 20%, 25% on figuring out what is next. Right? Yeah.
That's right. Yep. That's right.
And that's a couple of things will work and other things might not work, but at the end it's always good to be one step ahead of where things are going. So in relation to that, I mean, you've gone through various stages, startup, scale up, what have been metrics that you thought were very important, maybe 5, 6 years ago, that are completely unimportant today? What are you focusing on right now as your main thing to look at the health of your company?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. So, earnings or gross profit will always be the driver for businesses, because without, if you sell something for one thing and you buy it for something else, that delta, whatever it is, whether it's soft costs like people and infrastructure, hard costs like direct costs of that, like that number hasn't changed. It's an immutable law, right? Gross profit is oxygen for the business. It helps you reinvest in all of that. So that, I mean, to some degree, that part hasn't changed all that much. What has changed is that, at least on the public switch telephone network side of things, the complexion of the type of traffic that we're managing has completely changed over the course of the last 12 years. Primarily as people have moved away from wireline services to an entirely wireless world, right? So the only thing that exists on the wireline services anymore is either business traffic, right? Because all business numbers are considered a wireline number. There's no such thing as a wireless business number yet. We're trying to change that. But also, just machine generated traffic, so robocalling and fraud and all of that. So that has changed quite a bit, and the way that we view kind of operational metrics around network performance and value.
Yeah, but I get the these are more the metrics that you use to see where you can optimize the value for your customers, and that is then tied to like the revenue and the profit side, correct?
Correct. Yeah, correct. Yep.
One metric that I've come to appreciate more and more as I got more experience in the business is ARR per employee, because it said a lot about leverage. But again, it starts with value, and without a product or a service that people are prepared to pay a premium for, all these things are just illusions. Since things are happening so fast, and you're at the helm of the company, you're a founder, you're the CEO, of course. How do you keep yourself at the helm of what could be? Like, how do you keep fresh as the company grows and your attention just spreads out?
Well, for me, it's always the easiest way is you find it internally. You find it by listening either to your people or listening to your customers. That's it. You're not going to find it at a seminar or a conference or anything like that. All you literally just have to listen. You have to quiet what you're doing, and you have to listen and watch and observe those around you, and that will tell you where things are going to go, right? Either they're going in the wrong direction, or they're going in the right direction, or they're headed towards a specific thing, right? And then just asking yourself, are you still solving the same problem you were when you started?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that question of like, what is the business we're really in is such an important one, because so many companies think they are this and they are actually something else, and it locks them up, and it's yeah, it gets you on the, it gets you starting on the wrong foot. Is it yeah? The definition of the problem is a super important one. How often does that problem actually change for you since 2012? How have you seen it evolve?
Well, I think you have to be honest with yourselves on whether the problem's changed, or I think it's more about whether you actually still want to solve the same problem, right? So are you really solving the problem you originally thought you were solving, right? So when we originally started, it was we were thinking around how do we make carriers more efficient. That problem evolved into how do businesses communicate and how can they do it more effectively. Now that's the problem we're most focused on. Less about whether we have the most performance technology on the market today. It's more about how if the customer is ultimately trying to be more efficient or to have better adoption of their technology and inside of their businesses, are we even solving that particular problem with any of our technologies, right? Like, are we solving that one, right? Because customers will come to you and say, I have this box. I know that this is, I need to fill this box, right? Stepping back a little bit and questioning, look, you're asking to fix this box, right? But really, what you're really asking for is something completely different, right? And, if we can solve that for you, it fixes three boxes that you needed to fix all at the same time. So
Yeah, true.
that's what we've really tried to focus on. And the customers will tell you that. You just have to listen to them.
Yeah, well, you open up a whole box and another again. I mean, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and trait number four is remarkable software companies master the art of curiosity. This is really about that. So, of course,
It
when you're the
is,
founder of the company, likely your buying date, you're curious, but then you start growing and growing and growing. And how do you keep that same curiosity muscle going at every layer of the company?
Well, especially in the sales organization, right? So in a sales organization, everyone's focused on selling, right? They want to be able to figure out how to sell, to sell into the customer, because it ultimately allows them to hit quota and make more money, and it's good for the business's top line and all of that. But that's a very short-term thinking. Part of the culture that we have that I'm proud of, and that our sales team has adopted, is really kind of sitting down in a consultative role and just saying, look, what are you struggling with? Like, what do you like? We brought us in here to solve a communications problem, but what ultimately are you struggling with? Because we touch everything.
Yeah, that's true. Taking it to the broader picture, connecting it to other problems in the company rather than just the project that the customer thinks it's trying to solve. Strong. And it's all about asking those type of questions. And that's practice. And not only in sales, by the way, it's in every part of the business. I want to keep track of time here. I got one more question, well, two more questions. What has been a big lesson that you learned that you still benefit from today over the last 12 years?
Stay lean, always stay lean. You have to stay lean more than anything. That's probably the biggest lesson, is you can't, regardless of how much success you're having, you can't, you have to stay lean. It not only does it, is it obviously more capital efficient for the business, but it actually forces people to stay focused. And it allows you to not lose your culture in that process on the ride up.
Exactly. Well, I mean, my second question was then, what would be a do and what would be a don't for, well, as an advice to other entrepreneurs that aspire a journey like you've been going through? Possibly the first, the do is already answered, but what would be a don't?
That's a really good question. Don't think it happens fast. It doesn't happen fast. Nothing happens fast. Even the fast stuff doesn't happen fast. It just looks like it.
Exactly. 12 years in the making.
That's right.
Exactly. Overnight success. Just took 12 years. But I mean, it's impressive the journey that you've been through. It's that inspired me from the moment I saw what you were doing. Thanks for making the time available today to share part of that, because we haven't there's so many else things too that we could discuss. Where can people go to find out more about the company or to say hi to you?
Sure, 46labs.com or LinkedIn. I respond to LinkedIn messages, pretty much every one of them, unless you're trying to sell me something, and I'm probably not going to.
Very recognizable. Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much, Trevor, to what you've been sharing. I'll keep following you, and maybe we'll talk in the next 3, 4 years about where you are right then.
Excellent. Thanks, Don. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. And this wraps up my conversation with Trevor Francis, founder and CEO of 46 Labs. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Torn. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.